now?
Sandra, we were talking about sexuality and basically exploring why is sexuality often experienced as a problem in society. And I suggested that I tell about my exploration of that topic and the four elements, the four aspects of that which I explored. The first was why is sex perceived as a problem, and separately I have explained that in my view that has nothing to do with sexuality, but it's actually about a continuation of the philosophy of enslavement, that if you want to treat people like slaves, you need to treat them like animals and limit what they can do, and the limitation of their experience of sexuality is part of that story. That brings me to the second part of the story out of the four, and the second is that in biology you can see that sex is actually a solution, and that it is a very clever means to get more information about how to live better and survive better on Earth as a life form, as a species, and as life on Earth in general. So the story that I'll go into now then leads up to the third story to follow later, which is about the experience of sex in our own body, and how in the onset of puberty we can actually see that all of these elements of the sexobiology, or the biology of sex, come together in its human form, and therein also connect the physiology to the psychology, the neurons to the hormones, and so on, and that there is actually a full shift of awareness that can take place in the sexual interaction. So part three then is about what happens in puberty and how do people learn to negotiate this sexual interaction, also the basis of relationships. And after that, the fourth part can elaborate on the outcome of that, which is once you have sexuality established as not just an act between two people, but as actually as a language, and not just as a prose but specifically as a poetry, then what happens when you can tune on the music of sex, and specifically orgasm, and how does that change consciousness? So that understanding that we're actually dealing not with sex but with a shift of consciousness is also the core of this second part of the story. In the second part of the story, I'd like to start with the really basis of everything as it is described in the origination of the universe. And for that, I'd like to use the model of tetrionics. Tetrionics is a new geometric description of defining of science. It describes how quanta can link up and form photons and bosons and form electromagnetic fields of information, and that out of the interaction of these electromagnetic fields of information, particles can arise. And that these particles then actually lead to the interaction of, let's say, information and matter in two forms. One of them is the linear flow of the electromagnetic field over the matter, which is in tetrionics called the Kempf field, the linear, the in-out flow of energy and information. And the other part of that is called the BEM circulation, which is the internalized loop, let's say the energy within matter. And I like to go back all that way to tetrionics and its description of how quantum fields form matter and move matter, because what we see at the level of the linear flow in the quantum field, we later see as the linear DNA in the cell, and what we see as the circular flow in the quantum field, we later see as the circular DNA in the cell. So there's good reason to go back all the way to the basis of quantum fields, because what happens there still happens at the level of the atoms, at the level of the cells, and at the level of our body. And so in that sense, we need to understand our whole being as a quantum field with, say, different shades of development and refinement. There are many levels that can be described in between, but what I'd like to describe next is a possible interpretation of how the universe is formed, then a possible interpretation of how life is formed, and then also a description of how we can understand that that forms us. So on the basis of the quantum description of tetrionics, we can then see that the whole universe started as a field, a quantum field of pure information. That then would conceivably have led to an electromagnetic subatomic particle sea, in which particles are formed, reformed, transformed, and connected up, which is called the Van Oort gas cloud in astronomy. Then out of these Van Oort gas clouds, there will be ball lightnings, which we call stars, for the simple reason that this Van Oort gas cloud is like a lightning cloud, a thunder cloud, in which lightning discharges will trace lines of charge discharge through that whole immensely large field. And these will result in crossing points where odd numbers of these charge discharge lines will connect and form ball lightnings. These we know are the stars. They will be at very precise positions in the universe. And little blobs of that, what happens in the sun, will pop out and solidify around them, and that's what we call the planets. So when we look at life on Earth, we are still dealing with these electromagnetic phenomena as they take place in the quantum field, the Van Oort gas cloud in the stars, and on the planets. But on the planets, we will see it take place in the form of the manifestation of life. There is a hypothesis that when the planets were formed, and internally they're still liquid, the crust is sort of solid in different ways. Around it there is the atmosphere of air, and around that there is the electromagnetic ionosphere. So essentially the four elements of the alchemist are still there, but there is an interplay between them, because a charge discharge of the ionosphere through the atmosphere can lead to the formation of amino acids. That is the hypothesis, that in the primordial Earth, the primordial gases on Earth would conduct the lightning, but in the wake of the lightning, the atoms in the atmosphere would have become ordered and produce what we would call the amino acids. So they would be, say, the counterpart of a charge discharge and lightning rod on Earth, essentially showing how the balance between time and space of the lightning discharge can materialize. And I refer to this balance between light and space because at some point a lightning expert, Kenneth Rand, told me about his experience with lightnings, and he said it always jumps a specific distance and then waits a specific time, always the same time and the same distance. So in that sense, a lightning is a zipper between time and space. And so when an amino acid forms out of that, the experiments have been done to show that it is possible, then the amino acid would be actually a kind of computation between time and space as resulting from the energy discharge in that information field. So let me jump ahead again, skipping a couple of steps in what happens then in... we're still working towards the biology of sex, but before we get there, we first need to get some biology in place first. So Gaston Nasson from France in Canada, Quebec, studied the formation of primitive forms of life under the dark field microscope. And he realized that there was a relationship between spores, which he called somatites, because they actually have the qualities of life within them. So they're like the smallest kind of living body that can be. And when they chain up, they can create fungus-like systems, basically an initiation of a fractal system. When that fractal goes two directions and can fractal out in both directions or all directions, then the form that arises out of that would be called a virus. And when that is encapsulated by, say, an oil drop membrane, then that would be called a microbe. So Gaston Nasson said that the formation of life actually is a cycle, and under the dark field microscope he could see that from a somatite, a spore, it could change into a fungus, say threads, lines, that it could go into a virus, which is basically like a kind of antenna going in different directions, and that it could go into a microbe and back again. So according to his perception, that would mean that the development of life and the complexity of life would depend on the specific conditions that apply. So let's look ahead again, and then we find the work of Lynn Margulis, who looked into what she called pond slime, the microbes that live on the earth. And so the pond scum is basically, for her approach, all of those groups of microbes that you can find on a pond. But it turns out that there are four types of microbes. The ones that live in the earth, called the anaerobic, or the oxygen-free, the air-free growing microbes. You have the ones that grow in water, the hydrobic microbes. You have the ones that can grow in the air, the aerobic microbes, and you have the ones that grow in interaction with the photosynthetic principle, the photosynthetic microbes, which actually interact with the light field. So there you have the alchemy of the basis of life in four microbes, which correspond with the earth, the water, the air, and the light or fire element of alchemy. In the view of Lynn Margulis, these four types of microbes are connected up at some point, and as she says, the transformation of life essentially is not based on the Darwinian selection of capacities and variations being tweaked out, and that out of the variation which gives something new, and the restriction which reduces that, that all of the life forms develop. There is also this other approach described by Lamarck, that there's an internal change in which an internal adaptation takes place, that different capacities are connected up. Think back of Gaston Nasson, where the somatite could form the spore, the fungus as a thread, which could form the virus as a tree branch going in multiple directions, which can then create a microbe. At the level of perspective of Lynn Margulis, you can then see that the microbes and the earth in the earth, the ones in the water, the ones in the air, and the ones in the light, could actually combine and form something new, which brings elements together which the one and the other have, but for them in a new combination brings out a newness, like a jump described by Lamarck. And for Lynn Margulis, it was that kind of synergy of species which are different, which are the actually breakthroughs of biology. And so when we focus on that merger of microbes, then we can see that there is a very fundamental form of the merger of microbes, in which one microbe will give information to another microbe about the life experience that it has. Before I can go into that, I need to include another description, which is that of Bruce Lipton, and he describes that for body cells, but we can actually understand that for the microbes as well. We need to understand that for the microbes here, because then we can fill up a gap in understanding how biology is able to combine information with matter, and how life forms are actually able to materialize knowledge in the form of genetic material. So Bruce Lipton, summarizing the work of others, says that there are four proteins: sensor protein, linking protein, the portal protein, and the DNA mantle protein. And together they define how information is taken into the cell. So as he describes it, there is an information field around the body. We always live in a field of vibration, and a sensor protein can respond to that. Then the linking protein will actually correlate the response of the sensor protein to the capacities of the portal protein. The portal protein can open a gate in the membrane of the cell and can close it, as a result of which molecules can go in and out. So the linking protein is actually the intelligence between, say, the brain and the gut, of the sensor protein and the portal protein, so that as a result new molecules can come in and old molecules can go out. And that's how the cells can feed on the environment, but they can also feed the environment. So essentially, we should always look at the excrement of cells as the food that they produce for other life forms in their environment. So it is not shit, but it is, or poison, which it would be for themselves, but it's actually food and information for their environment. So that linking between the sensor cell, the sensor protein, the linking protein, and the portal protein, then comes together in the effect of the DNA mantle protein, which will effectively write new knowledge, new experience into the DNA. Of course, there's a lot of DNA experience already. And if you think back, I mentioned that experiments have been done to show that a lightning discharge in primordial gases can produce amino acids. Then, by this principle generalized as presented by Bruce Lipton, we can understand how the DNA can become larger with the new information that it has. But of course, we can use that information also, that approach also, to understand how amino acids could have become proteins, which could have become RNA, which then could become DNA. So that essentially the development of life is the adding of information to the amino acid until it's large enough to become recognizable as a protein. And of course, at the protein level, we have the proteins, the enzymes, the hormones, and the pigments. Then as it keeps on growing, it can get the length of the RNA, and as it then stabilizes further, it can have the form of DNA, linear DNA and circular DNA. The circular DNA and the linear DNA are both aspects of the same story. It's just that the circular DNA, it is like a resonator, a ring. It is stable and is like a loop antenna. It will be selectively resonating to vibrations of the environment. But as a rod DNA, it will be like an antenna which can receive and transmit signals. So whatever happens at the level of the fundamental biology of life anywhere in the universe, there will be these little rod antenna of the amino acids, which can, if the circumstances are right, extend into the proteins, into the RNA, into the DNA. But there is also, think back of what I said about the description of tetrionics, of the chem-linear flow of electromagnetism over particles, and the BEM circular flow around and between particles, and then we can see that the circular flow is a resonant form of storing information, just as we see in the circular DNA in our body cells, while the linear flow then corresponds with the linear DNA in our cells. And now we have this understanding in place, we can understand that when microbes meet up and they learn in different environments, and by the Lipton mechanism they incorporate new information into their genetic material, they add new knowledge and new insight into their DNA, then their DNA will have grown, so that microbes which will have gone from through one environment will have added different information, new information, than would have been done by microbes that have gone through the other environment. And when these microbes meet up, it turns out that they can pass over the difference in learning from one microbe to the other. That's how microbes can learn to become immune to hospital antibiotics. This microbes that survived have that information of how they survived that. They can pass that over to the other microbes. And that passing of genetic material is the essence of genetic and sexual the sexual process. And that's where we suddenly see that we need to compare two life forms, the asexual transmission of information and the sexual transmission of information. So the asexual transmission of information is when the microbes internally divide and they replicate themselves and they replicate their genetic material by that principle of the vortex, which has been described in the separate story of the chakras and the story on the vortex. So we see the vortex at work in turning the system inside out and doubling the microbe, as a result of which, by non-sexual replication, you can have microbes which essentially live forever, because they clone themselves, and as a result the cell which we see now has been formed out of the cloning of the cell which lived maybe millions of years ago. The sexual form of propagation is that the cell will replicate if there is essential information of newness by which it will be possible to grow in that environment in which those cells live. And so we then suddenly see that in the asexual replication there is a continuity of what was, but in the sexual replication there is a need or a necessity or requirement for an input of a difference, a newness of something else, an otherness, in order to kickstart that process of replication. I mentioned the microbes passing a protein fragment with new information, because that is sort of in between those two versions, the asexual and the sexual replication. It is as if with the sexual replication the requirement of newness has become a condition for the continuity of the existence of that species, so that that species actually needs to be able to work with newness right from the start. And that means that that species is not living in a specific environment, but it is in that sense essentially living on the edge of two different environments, one with the genetic material of, let's call it, the mother, and one with the genetic material which is different of that of the father, and it must be sufficiently similar to be acceptable, recognizable, and usable, but it must also be sufficiently different to catalyze this change. And as you will find in the sexual replication, if the material is too similar, it doesn't work. Then it will be called incest with the result of regression, imbecility, that the system will fall back on earlier, more primitive, more basic forms of life, because the stimulation of the newness or the stimulation of the difference is not there to pull it out enough to be able to live on the edge. It is as if it needs to live on the edge of newness, on the boundary between what is and what can be. And in that sense, sexual replication has a different role in the propagation of life. And we can see that in biology and in nature. In, for example, the studies of the polders. I grew up in the Netherlands, and they have quite a legacy of reclaiming land by putting windmills around the side of a lake, putting a dam around the lake first, putting windmills on the dam, and then using the wind to pump out the water that falls in the lake until the lake is dry and you have more arable farming land. What intrigues me always is that the man who was said to have created that was called Leegwater, which means empty water. So the whole notion of building windmills on the dikes to drain the lakes is part of an intriguing history. What was impressive in that poldering process is that the first time that the bottom of the lake would be out of the water, and the aquatic environment would have been replaced by an environment in interaction with air, that the first plants which would come there would be of the cloning type, the asexual replication, and they would fill up the polder and they would live for a couple of years, and then by them binding nitrogen and other gases from the air into the soil, they would feed the microbes which used to be underwater microbes and now have been changed to aerobic and anaerobic aerobic microbes. So these microbes would be fed by those first asexually transmitting plants, and then after a couple of years the sexually transmitting varieties of plants would come in. It is as if the microbes which first were used to live underwater in one environment only needed to learn to merge with the microbes that interact with the air, so that the microbes deeper in the ground which work with the water, the microbes at the surface which interact with the air, needed to combine in such a way that they form a balanced microbial biotope in the soil, because it is the microbes that can then digest the minerals of the sand, the soil, and turn that into a soup which the plants can then drink, as a result of which they can connect their roots in the water and the earth and feed that soup through the stem to the leaves and the flowers in the air and in the light. The other way around, the leaves and the flowers will capture the light and the air and bring that back through the stem to feed it to the microbes in the soil. So it's a two-way process, just as what we see in the nerves in our body. So the transition between the asexual plant and the sexual plants are related to this, let's say, the seed quality of the plant which is in the soil, and the seed being able to grow out of the soil, to transcend the soil, to go up into the air and into the light, as a result of which these four elements of alchemy are united, and the plant actually is like a magical key connecting the four elements so that the specific environment and the specific climate are the balancing factor which actually produces a specific kind of plant, and as a result plants will always be specific for the link between the soil, the underground, and the climate that they're in, and that is where they can be used as healing herbs. When people, for their feeling, live in a kind of emotional or physical landscape, and at the same time they have a kind of psychological, emotional climate, then if they do not know how to connect the two, there might be a plant to show how it's done. So in the sexual diversification of the life forms, first we looked at the microbes, and then by the work of Lynn Margulis we can see that when the four kind of microbes came together, the earth, the water, air, and the light microbes teaming up to form what's called the eukaryote cell, the well-formed cell, then out of that these eukaryote cells were able to live on the earth, live in the water, live in the air, live in the light. Essentially, that is how the Chinese describe the qualities of the dragon. The dragon can walk the earth, swim in the water, fly in the air, and breathe fire. So the eukaryote cell is in that sense the connecting point between the four elements. And as Lynn Margulis then describes, that seems to be the key as a result of which we can see the repetition or the replication of what Gaston Nasson saw in the dark field microscope, that the somatide could grow out and form the fungus, it could grow out and form the virus, it could grow out and form the microbe. In the work of Lynn Margulis we see the same, that the eukaryote cell can extend to form the plant, the vegetative system, the fractal shape. It could also extend and form the animal system with the internal circulation, and it could also grow out and extend to form the consciousness, the sapience life forms, which not just a form of circulation of blood but also a circulation of information which is coherent, that is actually an internalized picture of the universe within the animal. And then of course we can see that every animal that can build a nest or can trek between different parts of the earth has that kind of inbuilt map. So the whales navigate, the sterns migrate from one pole to the other, and the inbuilt picture of the world seems to exist in probably all life forms. So Lynn Margulis was extending that understanding that in the microbes we see that it is the connection between the microbes which then builds up the linear form of say the plants, or the circular form of say the internal circulation, and combined that has the internal circulation and unfolding of information within the organism. Over the eons you can see that life forms have developed, and you can also see that for us, that at the moment that your father and your mother came together and had the sexual interaction, and out of that had sperm meet up with the egg, then you can see that out of that fusion of the sperm and the egg, the first cell of your body is formed, which is in that sense again the first microbe, or it is the somatite that Gaston Nassens refers to, or it is the tetrahedral tetrion that tetrionics refers to. So that first cell is then the pivot of the formation of your body. But in its formation there are two forces at work. One of them is that after having been formed there is a vortex within that first cell, the zygote, which will unfold it, we'll unzip it like a zip file in a computer. It will decompress it so that with the tuning fork of the DNA at hand to give the information of the radio field by which it can unfold, then you can see that the DNA will unfold that cell in a specific pattern. And Robert Becker has shown that in the salamander, and in the salamander egg, you can already see the shape of the salamander because the electromagnetic field is already implied in the DNA. And Peter Garayev showed that if you shine light on a DNA, and the information of the DNA will actually, like a hologram, be radiated out. So then we can see that the DNA actually is like a magic wand in the hand of the conductor of the orchestra, that it unfolds the first cell in a very specific pattern. But we cannot say that the DNA creates life, because we have already addressed the Lipton mechanism, that life actually creates the DNA. Life actually composed the amino acids into proteins, into RNA, into DNA. So that life creates the DNA, not the other way around. And we can see how that process works when we look the other way. When you look at the zygote and how it was formed, then you can see that it was formed out of the sexual fusion of sperm and egg, which was formed out of the sexual fusion of sperm and egg for each of the parents. So in that sense, you can see that the vortex which unfolds, unzips the zygote in forming the body is actually the consequence or continuation of a vortex or a fractal by which you have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and so on. And if you go back far enough, you'll find that you have more ancestors in that generation than there are people on the planet. So in that sense, you can see that we are all part of humanity. Humanity is one family, or in a different way, you can say that you are a cell in the body of humanity. And that humanity, like our body, is a colony of individuals living together, just as our body is a colony of cells living together. But the relationship between that body and the environment is by the incorporation of information into that body. And that's where we then need to address the biology of consciousness. And what Bruce Lipton described for the vibrations and the molecules around the cell being taken into the cell via the use of the sensor protein, the portal protein, the decision taking and the linking protein, and the archiving of the new experience in the DNA mantle protein, the same has been described without referring to the molecules, but mainly referring to the electromagnetic vibrations by James Oshman, who shows that all that we perceive from our environment is electromagnetic vibrations. It will need to be sensed on the surface of our skin. That's two-dimensional. It will be need to fed back into our body through the neurons and other pathways, which is one-dimensional. And there it will need to combine in an integrated picture, a pivot point where all of that information comes together, which is zero-dimensional. And so James Oshman describes that process of incorporation of information into matter from the perspective of the electromagnetic field. Hans von Reykjavik describes the same, but as sensations. And of course, all our sensations are in the form of vibrations. And so we can see the apple tree at a distance, and we can actually see if the apples are red and can be discerned from amongst the green leaves with the chlorophyll of the tree. Then as we get closer, we can actually smell if the apples are ripe or not. And then we can touch them, we can feel if they're hard or are already turning soft and going from acid to sugars. And then when we taste them, we in a way can analyze them and feel how the molecules of the apple can feed into our body. But of course the apple is, say, the zipped up version of the tree. It's the fruit of the tree around the seed. And so in that sense we eat the hologram of the apple, which is the hologram of the tree, which is the hologram of the life of the tree in its environment, with its subsoil, had the underground and the climate interacting. So again we actually take in the relationship between the environment and the climate and how they relate. When you look into that incorporation of that information into that body, then it is Herbert von Froehlich who showed that as the information goes into the cell, like Hans von Regewijk said, as sensory vibrations, as James Osman described it in the form of electromagnetic signals, which is also what Björn Nordenström, Robert Becker, Valerie Hunt, Itzhak Bentov and others looked at. There is an enormous level of electromagnetic information circulation in the body, and when it finally gets into the cells it has very high voltages and very stark electromagnetic principles across very small membranes. So suddenly there are computations taking place, just as what I described for the beginning of the universe, the lightning charge discharge in the universe as a whole, but now as charge calibration across the membranes in the cells. And when you look in the cells, all of those are electromagnetic organs processing the electromagnetic information and thereby having the ability to relate that information to the transformation of molecules. So the cells use the molecules that we find in our environment, and they can use nuclear atomic forces to transform those molecules by using the information of the environment to do so. And yes, we are still talking about the sex of biology and the biology of sex, because here we see that sex and biology is about the incorporation of information into matter, and sex is one of the aspects of that. That the information which has been brought into the body and has been materialized, condensed and condensed into matter in the body, can then be used to say work as backup floppy or a boot diskette for the cells in case that the charge discharge of the cell collapses. Now if, say, there is an electromagnetic pulse which wipes out the electromagnetic field in the cell, then the DNA can interact with the ambient electromagnetic field to project a hologram in the way that Peter Garayev demonstrated, as a result of which the cell can reboot and continue this atomic nuclear force interaction by which it can form, transform and reform molecules. This reboot principle is very nicely demonstrated by a little frog which lives in British Columbia, which every winter can freeze to the level that it's totally frozen, and in hiding it is just stored in a deep freeze, so to say, and then at the moment that the spring comes and the system starts to heat up again, that heat gradient is enough to create an electrical gradient, which is enough to catalyze an electric charge discharge in one of the proteins at the mantle of the heart, which then initiates an oscillation which actually reboots the heart, as a result of which it can thaw out the frog, which then can just wander on again. So we need to understand that in our body we have these kind of capacities. We have all kind of fallback systems in our body which are part of our biology, and we need to also understand that the biology of our body is connected to the biology of all other living beings on Earth, because in the food that we eat we forget what they write on the packages of you have so many energy, so many fats, so many sugars, so many minerals that you take in, because what we actually take in is not the energy of whatever food we eat, but we of course also get all of the trace elements which the food industry does not measure, but which is crucial for having the information to fine-tune these vortex dynamics of the cells in their interaction with each other and in their processing of information within our body. But in all of the food that we eat, we also eat the DNA and the RNA and the traces of the DNA, the fragments of the DNA that come along with the food that we eat. And in that sense, all of the life forms feed on other life forms. And it's not just that every life form can add to its own DNA by having the experience, by this Lipton mechanism of the incorporation of information and adding it to the DNA by the DNA mantle protein, but just like the microbe can share information with the other microbe by extruding a protein with that bit of information, likewise in the eating of other life forms, we also take in all of their DNA and we can compute their DNA into our DNA. So in that sense, the sexual interaction of life with life is much more general and much more encompassing than just the male-female coming together and the sperm and egg fusion leading to a new cell, a zygote, out of which a body can be formed. Actually, the process of the merging of sperm and egg, which in a sense is the merger of one strand of linear DNA with another strand of linear DNA plus a cycle, a circle of circular DNA, which in a way we could look at as two strands of DNA entwined in a circle. So then we can see that in the biology of sex, we are not just dealing with this sex thing as people have sort of started to look at this across this taboo which have been put in place by the Roman Church, which were acting on behalf of the slave masters of old Rome, old Greece, old Egypt and before. But we are dealing with the interaction between matter and information informing ever new forms of life in which all life forms are interconnected. And the information between the life forms is passed on in very many different ways. So at one level, all of the life forms take in the information from their climate in their environment, wherever they are on Earth. Between them, they cycle and recycle that DNA information, just as the microbe that has gone one way meets the microbe that has gone the other way, and by extruding a protein strand can pass on that information. In the asexual and sexual forms of propagation of life, you can then see that for some life forms it is imperative that new information is added into the system sorry about that, before it can restart. And actually, as I said before, if the new information is too similar to the previous information, it will actually regress. It cannot have a viable solution. So it actually does need the newness of the information to sort of live at the edge of newness for that specific life form. But then we can also see that sexuality is the fundamental principle which has many different aspects in which information can be incorporated into the life forms. And in that sense, all of the life forms of Earth are all interconnected and all life on Earth is in fact one species which has is one organism in which all of the species are like different organs, just as we have different organs in the body, and that each of these contributes a different part of the potential for development of life on Earth. Because evidently life and the inclusion of incorporation of consciousness on Earth wants to have the widest possible range of possibilities, so all of them are interconnected. And our experience is just part of that. So when we as humans look at sexuality, it is not that we should have guilt or shame in the way that the Catholics try to advocate that, but rather we could have pride and pleasure in the way that the Roman and the orgies and the other cultures in their sexual rituals used to have, because it is about sharing experience of your own being with others, and in very specific and very selective ways amplify that sensation of that deeper level of our being, of that information sharing, which is, as I described before, essentially an electromagnetic field interacting with the physical field, making it possible to make new forms of matter, new molecules, new amino acids, proteins, RNA, DNA. So that in the act of sexuality, we're very close to that interface between the electromagnetic field, which defines the life within us, and the physical field, which is only the carrier of it. So that's where we go to the alchemy of the elixir of life and the grail. The holy grail is the container which can encapsulate and contain and preserve life and vitality, and in essence that is our body and every organ in our body, and specifically the first cell, and as a result also the genetic material, the sperm and the egg. So in that sense the holy grail is the sperm and the egg, but only when you have the sperm and the egg together, like a two component glue. It's only when the sperm, which can live 3 days, and the egg, which can live 3 days, come together, that they can live for 120 years, more or less. And once you see that, then you can also understand that if the sperm, the egg, the zygote, the body is the holy grail, then the elixir of life is that electromagnetic field, the consciousness within it. And it's specifically the coherence of that electromagnetic field, and most specifically the capacity of that electromagnetic field to function outside of the limitations of its own conditions and conditioning. And that's where part three of the story will then unfold what happens in puberty and how we actually learn to transcend those limitations. But we're not there yet, because we first need to have some deeper understanding of how sexuality, which we now understand as not being sexual, but the combination between information and matter, using freedom of choice. So the freedom of choice lies in which partner do you choose to have offspring. And of course it is really important that you have your choice, but it is also evident that it is even more important that you have your raised consciousness in order to be able to make your choice. And that's the fourth part of this series of talks about sex and sexuality. That's only if you can activate your full consciousness that you can see which sex partner would be a good partner to mate with, because it is the properties and the qualities and the potentials of that sex partner which you will combine with your genetic material. And if that's not compatible, it just will not compute, and what comes out is either not viable, or the body will be defective, or the mind cannot process, or the soul cannot link up. Those different forms of problems are the result of not having properly computed how your information and the information of your sex partner can combine. And evidently this is very different from the story of, say, bloodline families who, through near incest, do the same as the tulip bulb growers do with their selective breeding, or what the Egyptians did with their selective breeding, that you go into the nephews and the cousin range to have enough distance, but enough sameness, so that you can selectively enhance traits. But that is in fact a very limited version of what biology and life actually needs, which is that you are able to compute if the DNA of the other combined with your DNA will mesh up enough to have strong enough sameness so that it can compute, but also enough differences so that it can open up and unfold. And it's intriguing that that process of sameness and difference, which is required at the level of the DNA, can actually be experienced in what will be described in part 4 of this story, in the levels of orgasm, in the sexual interaction between male and female. And actually it only works between a male and a female because it needs to have the hormonal and the neuronal opposition both activated, so that the female in which the hormonal is more expressive or more predominant, and the male in which the neuronal are more predominant, they sort of need to balance out to an equal level of relevance, which is possible by the male tuning down into the hormone and the female tuning up into the neuronal. But so that is what we already see at the level of the DNA matching, where you need to have enough similarity to, let's compare it to a stereophony music signal, that both loudspeakers know that they're playing the same melody, but there must be enough difference so that the two loudspeakers are not actually just doing more of the same and having a mono representation of the music, but between them they can unfold the stereo, that between them they can unfold that phase field or phase difference, so that you can actually, if you walk between the loudspeakers, and you need to have enough of those, go to the place where the musicians were at the moment that the music was recorded. Actually, homeopathy makes use of that in its transfer of information in the remedies that they use. So it's at that level of the relationship between information and matter that we operating in sexuality. And what we still need to do is fill the gap between our sexuality, between a vagina and a penis on the one hand, and the microbe being essentially the same and passing a strand of protein from the one microbe to the other. And so this is a story which is best told by you looking into the biology of diversity of sexuality. When I did that, I discovered that it is a fascinating range of topics, and that if you look for the sexuality of all kind of different species, you can see how very similar the sexes can be, or how very different the sexes can be. But you can also see that there are developments which are very impressive in, let's say, the logic of how it unfolds. For example, if you look at the flower, it is essentially the seed having been carried by the stem through the leaves into the flower, where the seed turns inside out, and it is as if you see the core of the seed turned inside out, open to the universe as a whole, and from there exuding its essence into the environment, which is done by other flowers as well. And these essences, say the somatized, the spores of that seed, carried by the wind, and then connecting up to another flower, which then has enough feedback, resonance feedback, so that it can sort of recognize itself and restart itself and reproduce itself. But then, of course, you can also see that there are elaborate forms of flowering in which insects and other animals are used to be the pollinators, and that there is a symbiosis. Again, as Lynn Margulis said, the greatest development in biology is always through the symbiosis, that insect forms then specifically go to specific flowers and then cross-pollinate them, or that even birds seek the nectar and have beaks which specifically fit in there, or moths that have beaks that specifically fit in a specific kind of flower. That there's not just a cross-matching of a selectivity of the say the proteins of the pollen of the flowers, that's a spore by which they cross-pollinate, but also that specific animal life forms have developed in such a sense that they are actually like a key between the one side of the species and the other. And over the ages you can also see how per species forms of the body have developed. And when you think of the flowers just being open to the universe and the wind carrying the dust to fertilize from one area to the other, the same happens in water. And then you can see that there is a kind of focusing on a more specific kind of interaction, and a more selective kind of interaction, as for example you have with the birds, where the flower is sort of contained with behind a ring muscle called the cloaca, and like the anal ring or the vaginal ring or the ring of the mouth muscle, a ring muscle, the cloaca of the one bird will need to positioned over the cloaca of the other, so ring opening over ring opening, and then just like the microbe would be able to pass over the protein strand, the one bird is able to pass over the genetic material, which is of course already a lot improved over what you see in the flowers in the wind or with the frogs, the one laying the eggs and the other flushing the sperm over it. So in a way you can see that from the flowers to the frogs to the birds, there is a more and more selective and more specific partner seeking. It's not the sperm going up in the wind in all directions, and you need to have so much that you can hope that it will trigger another flower somewhere to fertilize. Or it's not like the frog needing to find the other frog so that they can flush the sperm over the egg. You can see that with the fish when they're spawning and so on. With the birds you can see that they have a cloacal junction. From the shark you can see how that actually led to the development of the penis and the vagina, because there are sharks in which they have this cloacal kind of connection, just like the birds have, but then the lips of the cloaca on the one side and the cloaca on the other, they started to transform a bit. I really recommend that you look this up and look into the development of the shark, because the lips of the cloaca in the one side started to go out a bit more like prongs, that they could open the lips and sort of hook up within. And then you can see that there is actually this this protruding part of the lips and the opening or being open part of the lips, which then start to interact. And over the ages, you can see that this protruding part, one becomes longer, the other sort of atrophies again, and the one is actually used to penetrate into the other lips rather than just holding them. And over the ages, you see that the penis is then actually shaped as something that penetrates. And when you look at the different animal forms, with the horses, with the elephants, with so many other species, you can see how the penis is then the complement of the vagina. So in that sense, the vagina offers the space which the penis can then fill up. But the whole purpose of it is that the fusion of the sperm and egg does not happen to have in the air, it doesn't happen to have in proximity in the water, it doesn't happen by just the cloaca giving space and nobody knowing how much leaks out, but that you can actually deposit the sperm close to the egg inside of the body of the female of the species. Of course, the female to be understood as the one that can produce the offspring. If you look at biology, it could be the male, it could be male and female alternating. There's so many variations to the theme. It's really worthwhile to look into that, because in all ways and all possibilities, you see that the whole of sexual biology, or the biology of sex, is aimed into a more and more precise selectivity on which sperm is going to be connected to which egg. And that is where you then see that some of the life forms have these very precise, say, sculpted or engineered pairs of vagina and penis, in which they will fit up into each other. And the third part of the story then goes into the dynamics and the physiology and the psychology and the potential out of that merger, because then you also see that biology has not only made the selectivity of sperm and egg much more matched and much more precise, but it also has opened up the moment of fertilization and conception to be much more extended and much more aware. And there's such an immense difference between a flower opening up and the pollen just being blown by the wind, or the fish swimming by and the other fish needing to be clear enough and near enough to be able to fertilize with the sperm, or the birds connecting up and needing to be in direct contact for the transfer of the genetic material to be possible, or those animals where the copulation process is actually something that extends over a long period of time, and where the selectivity and the specificity is really immensely calibrated. And there are so many stories to tell about animals where the penis of the male is actually broken off together with the sperm sac to be incorporated into the body of the female. There are the examples of the cockroach, where basically one male will fertilize the female for the rest of the life. There is the stories of the bees. There, you need to have a couple of the drone of the males to fertilize the female, who then can use that material essentially for the rest of her life. You have the stories of the praying mantis, where the male will have to go into this ritual of mating with the female, after which he becomes the protein snack for the female, so that she can better produce the sperm that he has contributed. There's the stories of the spiders, where the male will have to move into the much larger female and see if he can get away with his life. There's so many variations of how all kind of animals do it. And I was really fascinated by looking into that, because on the one hand it showed me how enormously rich this variation is of not just the production of this platform for copulation by becoming ever more precise and ever more detailed and ever more matching in the creation of a penis and a vagina, which was the outcome of millions of years of evolution, but also that the moment of copulation itself has been developed and explored in so many variations between so many different species, that out of that you can get an understanding of the kind of music and melody that we humans interact with in this process which we experience in our body of, let's say, the symphony of the male and the female. And much more specifically, that we need to look beyond the mere passing of a DNA or a protein strand from one creature or one microbe to the other, but that had this passing of a baton, a magic stick, magic wand of information, of unfolding information in the body, is actually extended so that that moment of the passing of the information becomes melodic, becomes musical, and becomes symphonic. And that is what the fourth part of the story will be about the symphonic aspect, which is possible for us humans and many other animal species, where the process of copulation is so long in time or so frequent in frequency that it is actually possible to learn that language of sexuality and to start to understand the subtleties of it and to operate and work with the nuances of it. So in the study of the biology of sexuality, there is a vast knowledge if you only look beyond the human species, and if you only realize that sex is a solution and always has been a solution. And once you start to comprehend that every notion that there's something wrong with taboo has always been created by people who want to manipulate people into fear and control them by fear. Because when you look into the diversity, the variety, the broadness and the sometimes exclusivity of sexual interaction in biology, you can see that it is a normal process of life, and it is essential to life. If you want to have a form of life which is able to migrate from one environment to the other, you need to have sexually reproducing species. You need to have information from the one territory and the other territory. You need to have the information which transcends the limit of the own existence. And so then you can see how the sexual forms of reproduction complement the asexual form of reproduction, but that together they're just like the radar dish and the radar microphone of a transmitting and receiving system. Both are needed because life on Earth needs to explore all options, and as people might say, hedge all bets. You need to have preparations for all the different options, even the ones that are least probable. And that's something where humanity still needs to learn, that the fringe people in humanity, they are essential for the survival of humanity as soon as the circumstances change. So the penniless and the homeless and the whatever else less are the tutors at the moment that our very fragile experience in our cultural conditioning collapses. Then those will be the people that will able to help us out and show us a different direction for survival. Biology shows that life has done that in general. There are very many variations to the theme, and it is characteristic for the importance of sex in biology that, for example, when water engineers need to test the quality of water, the purity of the quality of the water, they use a specific shrimp which will copulate as much as it can, so essentially all of the time, with a bit of recovery in between. But at the moment that water is polluted, they cannot do that so well. So their sexual activity is then the indicator of the quality of the water that they live in. And in that sense, if you go beyond the moralization of Freud and others, you can see that the libido and the sexual expressiveness of people is also related to the way that they're connected to themselves, and they're not hindered or hampered by stress, survival stress, relation stress, and other kind of stresses of disempowering them within the environment that they live in. That is essentially what I wanted to say about the biology of sexuality. Evidently, what I presented is only an introduction, because the real story is to look into the diversity of the biology of sexuality for yourself. The only thing that you need to do that is to realize that whatever you've been told about sex is wrong. Sex never is a problem. There is no morality or judgment about sexuality. Whatever morality of sexuality there is about the purity of the relationship between people, but never has anything to do with sex and sexuality. Sexuality is simply a means by which life forms on Earth and in general have the capacity to incorporate information from other beings to optimize the next step in the development of life on Earth. You're part of that. Your sexual experience and expression is part of that. So in the next part of the story, I'd like to address what happens at the moment that you wake up to sexuality, and what can you expect in your body and from your body. But more specifically, what do you need to look for that goes beyond your body into the psychology and the sociology of sex. So that will be part of the third episode of this sequel. And then the fourth part of the story is what can happen when you transcend that understanding that sex is biological, when you start to understand that it's actually psychological, in fact it's sociological, in fact it is transcendental, that sex is not about the propagation of the species, but more about the propagation of the consciousness of the species. And that's where we then end up with the magic of sex and the realization of sexual experience as a transformer of consciousness. So I'm just concluding what I now expressed about the biology of sex. The essence is that it is all about the connection of information and matter with the use of freedom of choice. The story of freedom of choice is a separate story, so that will not be elaborated here. In the biology of sex, we see how it has to do with life forming on Earth. In fact, how Earth itself formed out of the universe. All of it is interconnected, and all of it amounts to the ability to get very precise information for the manifestation of life on Earth. In the biology and all the variations that we see in all the life forms on Earth over the ages, it is possible to see how wide the scope of sex is, how varied the scope of sex is, how one form seems to be the opposite of the other, and yet they complement each other. All of them are different variations of the theme of how can we best integrate information with matter. And that is also where in the next part of the story we must realize that we are not dealing with the biology of sex, but basically the sex of biology. We need to see that biology is only half of the story. We need to see that it is what we can see in a body, which shows or hides what is going on at the level of information. And we need to see that the variety of the forming of biology is actually an expression of different forms of learning how to interact with Earth. So that the forms of biology are actually different forms of consciousness which have gotten different wrappings or different handles or different tools, or different instruments, so that that form of consciousness can explore the Earth. And to conclude, it may be helpful to realize that in physics, people often refer to the second law of thermodynamics as when energy is used in the universe, it tends to get lost. In fact, the energy never gets lost. It is simply that the energy that we see moving in matter at some point goes into the matter and then moves the molecules, and at some point goes from the molecules into the atoms and moves the atoms, and at some point that energy will move the information field that is at the basis of all. And from there you can see that all of the information which is seemingly lost are swept under the carpet of consciousness of the physicist comes out from under the carpet as new and more able and more general and more specific forms of consciousness, and ever more complex and ever more intelligent and ever more capable forms of life. And in biology we actually see that whole process. And sex is the way in which we can connect those processes amongst them, because we can see how they actually interrelate by the exchange of information. And that is what sex is about. So I'll round this off here, and then I'd like to go into the next part of the story, which is about how we experience all of this.